That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
Doing us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The UN General Assembly has overwhelmingly voted in favor of a resolution that calls for an immediate, durable, and sustained humanitarian ceasefire in Gaza. 153 nations voted in favor, which is unprecedented in itself. Similar to the U.S. veto of the UN resolution for a ceasefire, which again the U.S. was left isolated on the world stage. Additionally, U.S. allies like the EU are pushing for sanctions against extreme Israeli settlers in the occupied territories. That, combined with the U.S. impatience with Israel, who said that Israel's genocidal war is contributing to its isolation, which is reflective of a growing split between the two. Let's find out what our guest thinks. Let me introduce them. Larry Johnson is a former CIA analyst who joins us from Bradenton, Florida. John Phoenix, journalist and international relations expert, joins us from London. Larry Johnson, let me first start with you. So you have the UN General Assembly that has voted for a ceasefire. You had 153 nations that voted in favor. And that included also allies like France, Australia, and India, and also Canada. What do you think about this vote where you have so many countries and even U.S. allies that are breaking from the U.S. when it comes to the U.S.-Israeli carnage that's happening in the Gaza Strip?
When all is said and done, it's not going to stop the removal of the Palestinians from Gaza, unfortunately. This is, you know, I guess you can appreciate that the growing sentiment against Israel's genocide, because that's what it is creating more PR problems for Israel. But the reality is this: Israel's destroying the hospitals. They are targeting destroying the schools, targeting and destroying the critical infrastructure for sewage, water, and no food distribution. Nobody can live there. They're making it deliberately unlivable, and the world really is sort of figuratively sitting on its hands, even though it's voting to condemn Israel. They're not steps that could be taken, such as Turkey cutting off the oil supply to Israel. They're not doing that. So I'm a bit frustrated, I guess, with what I'd call the heated rhetoric, which is not being accompanied by actual action.
All right. Let me turn to you, if I can, John Phoenix, and ask you about why the world is watching in that atmosphere where, since, for example, Article 99 was invoked by the UN Secretary General, of which the U.S. used its veto, you had about 700 or 800 Palestinians that have been murdered since then. We just had a report where you had some Palestinians that were shot at point-blank range. And you have so many other war crimes that are continuing to happen at a rather alarming pace, I might add, especially after that resolution that the U.S. uses veto power. There should be something that should prevent that. What mechanism is there? What is there that can do that?
Well, I mean, it's clear by looking at the vote, which is 153 countries obviously voted to immediate ceasefire. I was shown one thing. Number one is the main player on the issue is the United States government, especially obviously Biden himself. The support of the Israelis will not have a free hand to act in the barbaric manners that way they're acting in Gaza without the umbrella of the United States. And that shows from the vote that the whole country, which is 153, voted immediately for a ceasefire and stop the genocide in Gaza. Yet one vote, which is a veto, American veto, okay, blew up the whole picture, which is, means that the United Nations, as other leaders in the past called them, reform. It is not really fair that United States will hijack United Nations by just overcome 153 countries' votes. So they need, number one, reform for United Nations. And that is one important thing. Second thing is that the Israelis will not behave like this without knowing that even the call for the International Court of Justice, they should face crime charges. That's not going to happen, because if you notice, the chief executive of the International Court of Justice, Mr. Khan, visited the Israeli side, and yet he refused to visit Gaza and see the crimes and the barbaric attack on the civilians, the killing of women and children. So they know they were not going to be called for an account. And that, sadly, I had to be open with you. The only way to overcome this issue is to keep the resistance of the Palestinians. You know, we see that in Vietnam. We see that in Afghanistan. After 30 years, the American imperialists ran away from Afghanistan. If you want to rely on an institution like United Nations, that's what's not going to happen. Sadly, the continuous resistance by the Palestinians, that's the only way can stop these massacres. Yet, as somebody going to ask, but they are killing civilians. This is actually a coward, barbaric act by the Zionists. If they wanted really to get rid of Hamas, they should fight Hamas, not public schools and hospitals, as your honorable guest just mentioned. Killing, bombing hospitals and schools and sewage, obviously, bombing the clinics, bombing the United Nations, even United Nations schools, which used as a refugee. As the Palestinians sadly believe this would be safe haven, a school with a massive flag of UN. But the Israelis had no regard to anything. You know, the only regard the Israelis do, will respect is the resistance. As you see, the language has been changed lately by the Israeli top criminals and the so-called defense ministry about the situation in Gaza.
You know, I'm very tempted to, and I'm going to go ahead and ask you this question, Larry, where if you recall during the Yemen war, where there was a coalition in the beginning, this is a U.S.-backed one, where the Saudi coalition was bombing Yemen for 9 years. Right. Many analysts that we had, not only on this program but elsewhere, they were cited as saying that if this war, if there was a will to stop this war, the United States could do that with one phone call because it started in Washington.
Sure.
I'm very tempted to ask you, and I will ask you the question when it comes to this one, because we see that the U.S. comes out making statements like, watch out for civilian casualties, make sure you don't target women and children. But at the same time, there's an endless flow of weapons that goes to Israel, which enables Israel to kill women and children. So I'm trying to get an explanation on that, if you maybe can assist me.
Well, look, the United States is enabling Israel to do this. And if it's halted the shipment of the ammunition, the bombs, the artillery rounds, and told Israel, we're going to cut off your economic aid, the war would stop. But that's not going to happen, because the Israeli lobby in the United States under the American-Israeli Political Action Committee, AIPAC, is so strong that Israel enjoys majority support among the Democrats and vast majority, overwhelming majority support among Republicans. So politically, it's just not a feasible option. But that would stop it in a heartbeat. You know, when you observe what happened in Yemen, once China intervened and brokered peace between Iran and Saudi Arabia, that war came to an end, because the entire purpose of that war from the U.S. standpoint was to try to weaken Iran. And the Saudis up to that point had played along. Well, they stopped playing along once with the help of the intervention of China and I believe Russia. And that war stopped in an instant. The killing stopped. The same thing could happen in Palestine, but it's not going to happen because there is no political will to do so in the United States, despite the protests. Yeah, there are some protests and there's some vocal groups, but they don't have enough power or clout or money to shift the policy.
Well, let me see here. John, if I heard you correctly in the last statements that you made, you said that they should come and fight Hamas instead of targeting hospitals, killing civilians, women, children, etc. As recent as just a few days back, you had the Israeli military spokesperson come out and said, we're not too sure how many Hamas fighters we have actually taken out. If the Israeli military does not know how many Hamas fighters they have taken out, then how is it that they're continuing with what you said, targeting civilians, which is obvious when 70% of them are women and children amongst them, if they don't know whether they're progressing or not when it comes to this war?
Well, the whole tactic, and this is also not the first time, even the previous war in Gaza, the whole tactic that you inflict as much as you can harm and killing and obviously starvation on the population, because they believe the population is the water for the fish. So get rid of the water. This is Shimon Peres's policy, that if you get rid of the water, then you can catch the fish. But the whole plan is to attack the civilians, cause really, really harm, as you see now for the last 60 days, a true genocide, killing children, women, destroy everything moves, you know. That's what they believe, that's what Hamas to give up. And on the other hand, they told the Gazans, I think 10 days ago, that if you be able to get rid of Sanwar is the leader of militant Hamas in Gaza, we will stop the bombing. So they wanted to throw the ball in the court of the civilians who have got no power to do anything other than just get killed and bury their children. You know, so this is an old and new game, to inflict suffering on the civilians, which means that the fighters will be able to give up. And obviously, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. They keep saying, from lie to another, that we killed this, we killed that. We have tunnels. They didn't know where is the tunnels. They didn't know where is Hamas. They didn't know. It's a group. You know that on the militant issue. I could be a normal person at night and day and next hour. I'm a militant, you know, with the jeans and a white shirt. They didn't know what they're doing. There's no objective. There's no plan, political plan or military plan. Now they talk about, obviously, the flooding the tunnels with water. Where is the tunnels to flood them? They didn't know where the tunnels. So far, we didn't know from them how many Hamas they killed, 60 right. days. But we know they killed thousands. They killed nearly 6,000 children, 4,500 women being slaughtered. You talk about nearly 80,000 Palestinians being slaughtered, and maybe nearly half of this, children. They destroyed the 65% of houses being destroyed. They would have destroyed the whole strip, hoping that the people would move out, and people saying, no, we want to die here. They thought with this intense criminal act, the people will run to Egypt or people will run to the sea. It's not going to happen. But as I said again and again, if they aim to kill Hamas and get rid of Hamas, they should come man to man and fight Hamas, not go in the sky with an F-16 and bombing children midnight. Okay. This is a really barbaric act.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, from there to Larry Johnson to how the U.S. President Joe Biden is warning Israel that it's going to become isolated on the international scene. And it's been described as Biden delivering a rebuke to Netanyahu if it doesn't watch out for the scale of civilian casualties. I mean, that's a mouthful, but how true is it in terms of the way that this is described, a rebuke from Biden? I mean, Israel is isolated at this point. The numbers of Palestinians that have been murdered speak for themselves.
It's meaningless. It means nothing. You know, Netanyahu doesn't care. The only thing that would capture the attention of Netanyahu and the Israelis is if Joe Biden, instead of making some idle threat, you know, some idle criticism like this, if he turned around and said, okay, I'm calling a halt to all U.S. military flights to Israel, effective immediately, and we're going to suspend foreign assistance to Israel, effective immediately. That would get Netanyahu's attention. He would then care. You know, the reality is, yeah, Israel is more isolated now than it has been at any time in its history, diplomatically, and yet it doesn't care. It's going to pursue this, and its murderous policy against the Palestinians without any regard for their lives. And this is the Zionist vision, and they are pursuing it ruthlessly, and they're going to continue to do it until the Palestinians are forced out of Gaza. You know, so it's not it remains to be seen how long Hamas can continue fighting. They're inflicting a number of casualties on the Israeli occupation force. But, you know, Israel still has time on its side. And as long as it is not facing any kind of economic consequences for its actions, it's going to continue doing it.
All right. So, John, this next move by the EU, making an announcement with EU Foreign Policy Chief Joseph Borrell, that the EU is mulling sanctions against what they have described as these Israeli settlers in the occupied West Bank for the violence that they're exercising on them. They're very alarmed. The EU is very alarmed that these settlers are exercising violence. I'm not too sure what to make of it when they don't have to look that far to see and get alarmed by the carnage that's taking place in the Gaza Strip. So why would they come out and make this statement in terms of sanctions against settlers and not make a more of a big deal about what's going on with the Palestinians that are getting murdered?
Again, as I want to say that the EU aware of the settlers' activities in West Bank, not today, not yesterday, nearly 30 years. They repeatedly receiving calls and receiving reports of the settlers' attack on the civilians in West Bank. Last year, they attacked the city, or the small town, actually, Hawara. They burned the houses, they burned the cars, they killed people, they injured hundreds of people, and actually was supervised by the Israeli army, you know, because I seen an advert, actually, in Hebrew, telling them when to come, which day, and where to gather. And I still have a copy of that. The European Union aware of that. Okay, Joseph Borrell went to visit the border of Israel with Gaza, and he was taking tour by the Israeli officials. They show him that what happened by Hamas, but he would not even dare to think to go to the Palestinian side. And when he was asked on Al Jazeera about the what happened, he was only condemning Hamas. And when when he was asked, what about the killing of the Palestinians? He said, well, I'm not an international lawyer, you know, I don't know. So he is one hand a qualified international lawyer to judge that the Palestinians committing by the attack on the 7th of the of October, committing a crime according to the international law. When it's come to the question about the Palestinian, you know, being suffering and killed daily, he said, I'm not an international law, lawyer. So it is a hypocrisy of the West. They've been watching these crimes for nearly 30 years since Oslo. Expanding settlement in West Bank, it's never stopped, you know, although the signing in Oslo not to do that. The settlers have been actually cutting trees. Some of the olive trees, 2,000-3,000 years old. They just chopped them. They attack shepherds, they attack farmers. How they now suddenly they wake up and, you know, one morning and said, oh, this is wrong. We're going to actually stop these guys coming to our countries. No visas. This is not the action we need to talk, to take. The action we take is the dismantle of the settlement, you know, completely, because they are against the international law and occupied land in West Bank. So this is just a PR. And in regard to your very quick comment, in regard to your comment about the question about the Biden attitude toward the civilians, he was told in the beginning of the war how many thousands of people dying, and he said, no, I don't believe the Palestinian story. I don't believe the figures is correct. You know, now suddenly for obviously PR for election indeed. Coming soon, we have election coming soon in the state. Yeah, there are lots of pressure by the Americans, which is I salute. The hundreds and thousands of the Americans went on the street calling for ceasefire. So when we say Americans, we mean the regime in the state.
Sure.
Because a lot of people walked in the street and said, "This enough is enough. This is massacring civilians."
Of course. Well, so it's sad, Larry, to have political advantages that Biden sees instead of caring for the lives of Palestinians. But there are messages that Biden is receiving from what we understand that I'm sure you're also well aware of in terms of diplomats, American diplomats in West Asia or Middle East, as some call it, are sending alarming cables to Biden saying, quote, Israel's military campaign is making the U.S. lose the Arab public for a generation. Or we, quote again, U.S. are losing badly when it comes to the battle space. U.S. support for Israel is viewed as moral culpability and war crimes. You said Israel is isolated on the international stage. The U.S., by some accounts, may have been isolated, not as much as the Israel, but this has really put that into a high gear, has it?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's, look, the position of the United States as an international power is eroding. It is still a powerful country, and the so-called international rules-based order is simply, you know, the United States gets to make up the rules and apply them arbitrarily as it sees fit. That is now being challenged, and it's being actively challenged. So you see the emergence of BRICS, and within this emergence of BRICS, you're seeing a reduction in U.S. authority and influence in the Middle East. But that is not going to save the Palestinians. They are headed towards being extinguished in Gaza. And I want to reemphasize, the only thing that's going to stop that is tangible action by countries that control the purse strings, the oil, things that Israel needs. And if nothing else, to try to impose a blockade on them.
Since you mentioned oil, my last question goes to you, John Phoenix. A front that Israel did not expect for it to reach the stage that it seems to be going to, and that is the front with Yemen. The Ansarullah movement and the Yemeni army have targeted vessels that are either originated from Israel, affiliated with Israel, or anything that has to deal with Israel, any vessel and any tanker. Do you think that will prove to be effective? In 1 minute, please, or less.
Yes, that is also proof that your guest is completely right. The minute the Israelis feel that there is no oil, there is no gas, no trade with the outside world, they'll be threatened. the way the our Yemeni brothers actually acting on the Bab al-Mandeb, you know, the Red Sea. I think this is a very, very effective tool okay. in order to pressure the Israelis.
Very well. Thank you so much. We do appreciate it. Let me thank our guest, Larry Johnson, former CIA analyst from Bradenton, Florida. Thank you for your comments. And John Phoenix, thank you, journalist and international relations expert from London. Thank you to you both. You. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitale and the team, it's goodbye.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, truthfulness. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. All the infallible and immaculate imams insisted and emphasized us for being truthful and avoiding lying. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the first divinely appointed imam, the commander of the faithful, he said, O people, be truthful. Surely Allah is with the truthful and avoid lying, for it stands far from faith. Don't we wish Allah to be with us? Of course we do. How can we make it happen then? Well, Allah is telling us through Imam Ali alayhi salam in this hadith by being truthful. Moreover, lying is something that stands far from faith. A person who possesses faith does not lie. It's a no-brainer, guys. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala does not expect us to lie if we have believed in Allah, if we believe in the Prophet, if we believe in Ahlul Bayt, if we believe in Quran, if we believe in Islam. We're not supposed to be from amongst the liars. Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says in one place, a servant of Allah does not taste faith unless he gives up lying earnestly or jokingly. Imagine, Imam Ali alayhi salam is saying that a liar is not going to be ever tasting the faith, the iman, right? Let alone them caring and being on iman and dying with iman. No, they won't even taste iman if they are liars. So we have to be very careful when it comes to using our tongues and our gestures to make a statement, right? We need to make sure that these statements are true to the best of our knowledge. Otherwise, we just stay silent. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing the trait of truthfulness. Before the break, we read to you a hadith of Imam Ali alayhi salam. If you notice that he is categorically rejecting the idea that liars can be considered faithful. A faithful person never lies, even jokingly. Unfortunately, lying jokingly is not considered bad in our societies. But if you look at the moral standards of Islam, lying jokingly is severely discouraged as well. You know, sometimes, you know, we say something and when it is proven wrong and, you know, the person who we have said it to or somebody else comes and approaches us and says, you know, that statement of yours was false. It was a lie. You know, we say, oh, we were just joking. Well, no, guys, this is not something that is endorsed by Islam. What do you mean you were joking? You are misinforming people. You are misguiding people through your lie, right? You can't just hide under the cover of saying that I was just joking. You can't make things up, right? So this is why it's important to notice that lying earnestly or joking both have the same consequence. And that consequence is that the person would not taste faith, according to Imam Ali alayhi salam. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam, the fifth divinely appointed imam, says, lies destroy faith. So let's say if somebody is not a liar and hence is a faithful person, a believer, then, you know, somehow they develop this habit of lying, right? What happens? It burns their faith. It just eats up their iman. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, keep on having fear of Allah, truthfulness, and trustworthiness.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsetodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsetodayEnglish.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit Doza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Another ship bound for Israel was targeted by Yemen's naval forces in the Red Sea near Bab el-Mandeb. The Norwegian-owned vessel was reportedly carrying fuel to the Israeli regime. According to military officials, the attack came after the vessel ignored several warnings from Yemen.
The naval forces of the Yemeni armed forces carried out a qualitative military operation against the Norwegian ship Stranda, which was loaded with oil and headed to the Israeli entity. The vessel was targeted with a suitable naval missile. Over the past 2 days, the Yemeni armed forces succeeded in preventing the passage of several ships who responded to the warnings of the Yemeni naval forces. We did not resort to targeting the Norwegian ship until its crew rejected all warnings.
The latest attack comes as the Israeli aggression continues to kill innocent Gazans. According to the latest figures, more than 18,000 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli bombings. Yemen's armed forces said they will continue to target Israeli ships until the genocide in Gaza ends.
The Yemeni armed forces confirmed that they continue to prevent ships of all nationalities heading to Israeli ports from navigating in the Arabian and Red Seas until they bring in the food and medicine that our steadfast brothers in the Gaza Strip need.
In response to Yemen's measures near Bab el-Mandeb, U.S. national security advisors have called for the formation of a new naval task force to safeguard the Israeli and commercial shipments in the Red Sea. Yemen's armed and naval forces have sent a strong message to Israel as they continue to impose bans on all cargo shipments to Israel. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
Portray yourself as the one fighting for the people and at the same time fight the same people, your own people. That are how many Iranians describe the Mujahideen-e-Khalq organization, or the MKO. A court session was held in Tehran on Tuesday to address a lawsuit filed against the MKO over its terrorist activities in Iran over the past 40 years. The lawsuit is aimed at highlighting the organization's crimes against the Iranian people and also the Western countries' complicity in these atrocities. Among the participants in the court are families of victims of MKO acts of terror in the 1980s. They blame the Western support for the MKO and want the organization to be brought to justice on an international level.
These terrorists have had an obvious connection with the U.S. in recent years. They have acted in line with the U.S. policies. The U.S., which claims to uphold human rights, has supported these terrorists. We expect the international bodies and tribunals to hold the organization and its supporters to account. Today, in our country, we see that the legal process is going forward, and we hope to see this process on an international level.
The Western countries have talked about human rights for many years, but we see that the human rights they are talking about have time and again been violated by them. The MEK atrocities against Iranians were supported by them. A woman says MKO terrorists murdered his husband right in front of her and their children in their own house.
My husband was at home that night. Two of the terrorists ran into our house. They beat me and my husband. After that, they started shooting at him right in front of me and my children.
The terrorist organization of MKO has not been convicted by any international judicial body. In the meantime, it has been supported by the Western countries, including the U.S., which makes them complicit in the organization's crimes. Farzana Shuryan, Tehran.
In Latin America, the Palestinian cause is seen as more than just politics. It is seen as a deeply important humanitarian issue. Across the region, people have showed up in great numbers in rallies held in solidarity with Palestinians being subjected to Israel's genocidal war on Gaza. Some of the Latin American administrations have also moved ahead of verbal condemnations and took more decisive actions. For instance, Chile's government recalled its ambassador. Bolivia, Argentina, and Mexico severed ties with the regime, and the Honduran government urgently summoned its ambassador for consultations. The resounding support for Palestine from Latin American nations that have had lots of great anti-oppression figures with resistance values like Simon Bolivar, Jose Marti, Fidel Castro, and Che Guevara is not surprising. In this regard, I talked to three Latin American ambassadors to Iran during their visit to the Latin America Cartoon and Caricature exhibition at the Tehran Museum of Contemporary Arts. Venezuela's ambassador to Iran censured the U.S. unwavering support for Israel, blaming Washington's backing for Tel Aviv as the main culprit for prolongation of Israeli onslaught.
La posición primero.
The U.S. is playing an undeniable role in the developments of Gaza. It has supported the regime's aggression against Palestinians and added fuel to the fire. Days ago, it was the U.S. that vetoed a U.N. Security Council resolution calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. The U.S. is supporting the Israeli genocide of Palestinians and is contributing to the continuation of this massacre.
The Bolivian ambassador also pointed to the U.S. move to veto a U.N. Security Council resolution that would have called for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza.
Unfortunately, we're observing that some international organizations are useless. For instance, a single vote can overturn the decision of the whole world in the UN Security Council. This failed system has led to the prolongation of the Israeli aggression.
Perez Ramos also called on the international community to put an end to the Israeli massacre of civilians.
The Bolivian government, as well as many other nations across the globe, has time and again condemned the Israeli genocide of Palestinians in Gaza. The international community must take more decisive actions to stop the regime's onslaught of Palestinians.
While having an estimated 60,000 Palestinian refugees, including their descendants, in his country, the Brazilian ambassador to Iran refused to directly condemn the U.S.-backed Israeli genocide of Palestinians. He only said it's a pity that the U.S. has blocked efforts to uphold a ceasefire in Gaza.
And we hope the United States will review its position, and we hope Israel also review its position after they see the catastrophe they are doing in Palestine. So I think even hardliner countries will have to be sensitive to the tragedy, what is going on in Palestine.
While the Israeli narrative continues falling apart, the truth has been uncovered for Latin Americans, like other people across the globe. That is, Palestinians are the ones subjected to decades of oppression, occupation, and ethnic cleansing.
Israel has for years sought to foster a close relationship with Latin American countries. However, the regime's ongoing onslaught on Palestinians has led to a seismic shift. That is, an exponential surge in anti-Israeli sentiment among Latin American nations. Mahdi Abbosian, Tehran.
Marking Human Rights Day by shedding light on the atrocities committed by the Israeli regime in Gaza and how the international community has failed to uphold what it considers to be a great humanity's achievement. The Foundation of Dialogue and Solidarity of Unified Nations, FODASUN, held its annual international conference on the future of peace and human rights in West Asia, as could be expected, focusing on the numerous instances of violations of international law and the Geneva Convention in particular, as Israeli attacks continue in Gaza.
Quite naturally, conference that puts the spotlight on the issue of human rights cannot be indifferent to the developments in Gaza. As we tend to discuss human rights in West Asia, we obviously have to examine how the Universal Declaration of Human Rights affects the lives of human beings in practical measures. What are the consequences when it's not observed? So in a way, today, we try to be the voice of the oppressed people in Gaza.
As one of the three pillars of the United Nations, it seems that the human rights is the one mostly neglected compared to peace and security and development.
The fact that there are many unresolved issues that can lead to wars in the West Asia region make it inevitable for us to discuss the issue of human rights violations during wars in this region.
As explained by the participants, the Geneva Convention is therefore considered the most challenging to implement, as the inability of the UN to stop Israeli atrocities and standing up for the people of Gaza has now come to light.
Just because actors violate international law, it doesn't kind of undermine the validity of international law. It just means that we need to work on better enforcement and better accountability mechanisms that we do always better in terms of implementation. Unfortunately, it seems that the 75 years that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights now is in existence, I think we have made progress in some parts, but we have also incurred many setbacks. And all I can hope is that we draw our lessons out of this horrible situation, and wisdom will prevail and a sustainable solution for peace will prevail.
Established in 2017, the Foundation of Dialogue and Solidarity of Unified Nations attempts to take positive steps in applying the concepts of human rights, particularly in a region where it is mostly overlooked. FODASUN hopes that by shedding light on the shortcomings that exist, it can bring a change for the better.
The participants of the 5th International Conference on the Future of Peace and Human Rights in West Asia believe that so far the international community has not demonstrated the willpower to properly implement the Geneva Convention. And what's happening in Gaza is a clear example of that. Gisumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
The streets of the occupied West Bank are empty. Transportation is disrupted while institutions, banks, schools, ministries, businesses, and shops are closed. As part of a global strike, that was declared in protest of Israel's ongoing genocide on the Gaza Strip. Palestinian activists and grassroots organizations have called for the global strike to demand an immediate ceasefire as Israel continues its aggression on Gaza. The call for the strike here has been decided by the National and Islamic Forces, who also called for the Palestinians from all walks of life to rally on this day for the sake of their own people being slaughtered by Israel in Gaza.
The whole world is on strike today. This strike is unprecedented in history. This stresses that all the globe is with the Palestinians. This comprehensive strike that has paralyzed all aspects of life in the occupied territories means the failure of the official level and the Security Council and the international arena to put an end to the Israeli occupation and its aggression.
We believe that it is important to show that there is a solidarity with the Palestinian people and that the world, young people mainly, and the citizens of the world, if you like, if we can say so, are against this war or against this aggression against the Palestinian people and against this genocide.
The protests come only a few days after the United States vetoed the UN Security Council resolution that called for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. Protesters here say the strike is also a message to the U.S. administration that stands against the aspirations of the Palestinians. They believe the U.S. is not only preventing an end to this war, but also backing the occupying regime to go on with its genocidal war.
It's also a message to the American administration that has used the veto while 13 countries rejected this aggression. This veto by the American administration gives a green light to Israel to go on and escalate its massacre of our people in Gaza Strip.
For 66 days, the Israeli military continued its onslaught on the blockaded Gaza, killing some 18,000 Palestinians and wounding nearly 50,000, the majority of whom women and children. Ending the Israeli genocide in the Gaza Strip and declaring a permanent ceasefire are today's urgent calls, not only of the Palestinians here in the occupied territories, but also of the free people all over the globe. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
Activists in Seoul, South Korea, continued their campaign to protest Israel's atrocities against Palestinians. As Israel's attacks on Gaza enters its third month, Tel Aviv's indiscriminate killing and illegal tactics are communicated to a growing audience.
Israeli media reported that Israeli forces have created a so-called massacre factory where they're intentionally targeting civilians using AI. And the U.S. is approving this. It's becoming clear that both the U.S. and Israel are war criminals in this genocide.
The killing of prominent Palestinians such as poet Rafat Al-Arir put more names and faces to Israel's crimes. Young people around the world are understanding that the diplomatic protection Israel receives from the United States in its UN Security Council veto costs lives.
When the UN vote concluded, I couldn't believe that they were really concerned about the loss of life. The United Nations should have called for a ceasefire. I am really disappointed that the UN seems like it wants world peace, but then says that such massacres are okay.
South Korea abstained from the most recent UN vote calling for a ceasefire. Still, as some Americans' criticism of Israel is muzzled, protesters in South Korea can say what they mean. As Israel continues its onslaught against the Palestinian people, the subject seems to have declined in prominence in the mainstream media around the globe. These demonstrators here, circling the Israeli embassy week in and week out, seek to remind people that the Israeli army is killing an innocent woman or child every few minutes. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, Iran has managed to foster a close relationship with Latin American nations, particularly those with a history of fighting imperialism and global hegemony led by the U.S., such as Cuba, Venezuela, and Bolivia. In recent years, Iran has managed to increase the scale and scope of its diplomatic and economic ties with Latin American nations. In this regard, Tehran has hosted the first edition of an international conference named 120 Years of Iran-Latin America Relations. The event was held at Tehran University. The organizers said the conference is aimed at reviewing the relations of Latin American countries with Iran and is considered an opportunity for researchers and political analysts to draw a new roadmap for communication and interaction in the future. Attending the event, the Iranian Culture and Islamic Guidance Minister said Iran and Latin American countries have a lot in common.
We seek to expand ties with Latin American nations. Definitely the U.S. and other hegemonic states are against any form of cooperation between like-minded countries. However, we believe that by boosting relations through cultural exchanges, our friendship will be long-lasting.
A number of Latin American ambassadors were present at the conference. They hailed the event as significant, calling for further expansion of ties.
The marking of 120 years of Iran-Latin America relations is a very important event. The main challenge we're facing today is culture. Despite extended political and economic ties between Tehran and Latin American nations, cultural ties require further expansion.
On the sideline of the conference, we asked the new Brazilian ambassador to Iran about the significance of Iran's cooperation with Latin American countries, especially Brazil, through mechanisms such as BRICS.
There will be new mechanisms to facilitate the trade. And in this, if this happens, not only Brazil, but other Latin American countries will have much more opportunity to have trade with Brazil. Last week, I received a big delegation from Brazil to purchase urea fertilizers for Brazil. So, to increase the imports from Iran and to, well, calibrate a little more the economy. But I think with those businessmen in Brazil, with the high-level visits in the horizon, and with new inventions of trade without depending on the other countries, I think we will have lots of new opportunities in the future.
Despite the geographical distance and cultural differences, Iran's political and economic relations with Latin American countries have grown warmer in recent years.
The next edition of this cultural event will be hosted by Venezuela in 2024. Matia Pusyan, Tehran.
The Zionist regime's air strikes have targeted a home in Gaza, killing the renowned Palestinian writer, poet, and professor Refaat al-Arir, along with six members of his family, including his two siblings. He co-founded a youth-led Palestinian nonprofit project called We Are Not Numbers. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, weeks before Palestinian writer and revolutionary Ghassan Kanafani was assassinated by the Zionist regime in 1972, a journalist asked what death meant to him. He answered, "Of course, death means a lot. The important thing is to know why. Self-sacrifice within the context of revolutionary action is an expression of the very highest understanding of life and of the struggle to make life worthy of a human being." Kanafani's tragic end, and those words of his in particular, came to mind almost immediately when, on the evening of December 7th, we received the painful news that Refaat al-Arir, like Kanafani before him, had been murdered by the Zionist regime along with members of his family.
In Rafat's case, his brother and sister and four of her children. In Ghassan's, his sister's daughter, his beloved niece, Lamis. The two men shared a resolute commitment to the Palestinian people and their cause. Both believed in and spoke about Palestine as a universal human issue. They had an urgent desire to record and propagate Palestinian culture and stories, and a fundamental belief in the righteousness of Palestinian resistance in all its forms. Both men studied literature. They were generous and passionate educators and writers. They also both spoke English with sardonic humor and eloquence and did not suffer fools or opportunists gladly. This combination, an unshakable commitment to their cause and the means to powerfully express that position in English to a global audience, is exactly why they were such a threat to the Zionist settler colonial project. Neither man was involved in fighting militarily, but both wrote about and understood the central role of literature, both in the Zionist colonization of Palestine and, crucially, in resistance to it. As Rafat explained in a 2019 lecture, when discussing Palestinian poet Fatwa Toghan and the role of cultural resistance, of course, we always fall into this trap of saying, Fatwa Toghan was arrested for just writing poetry. We do this a lot, even us believers in literature. We say, why should Israel arrest somebody or put someone under house arrest? She only wrote a poem. So, we contradict ourselves sometimes. We believe in the power of literature changing lives as a means of resistance, as a means of fighting back. And then, at the end of the day, we say, she just wrote a poem. We shouldn't be saying that. Moshe Dayan, a Zionist general, said that the poems of Fatwa Toghan were like facing 20 enemy fighters. And the same thing happened to Palestinian poet Darin Tatur. She wrote poetry celebrating Palestinian struggle, encouraging Palestinians to resist, not to give up, to fight back. She was put under house arrest. She was sent to prison for years. And therefore, I end here with a very significant point. Don't forget that Palestine was first and foremost occupied by Zionist literature and Zionist poetry. It took them years, over 50 years of thinking, of planning, all the politics, money, and everything else. But literature played one of the most crucial roles here. Palestine in Zionist Jewish literature was presented to the Jewish people around the world as a land without a people for a people without a land. Palestine flows with milk and honey. There is no one there, so let's go. And there were people, there have always been people in Palestine, but these are examples of how poetry can be a very significant part of life. The thing that perhaps connects Rafat and Ghassan, above all, is a fundamental choice they made both. The choice to stay in situations in which the likelihood of them being killed was high. Rafat was a highly educated academic, a specialist in English literature. If his primary objective had been to secure a life outside Gaza for himself and his immediate family, it could have been achieved. Likewise, by the end of 1960s, Kanafani was a celebrated novelist, a cultural figure of regional renown with a Danish wife, Annie. An escape route, and therefore a more comfortable, safer trajectory for both of their lives, was clear and within their grasp. Yet, like the unarmed author of the letter in Kanafani's moving 1956 short story, Letter from Gaza, Both men chose to stay amid the ugly debris of defeat to learn what life is and what existence is worth. People are generally divided into combatants and spectators. Kanafani once explained,